Well, David, you're just coming off of two very successful conferences, one in Orange County, one in Seattle. And, you know, I have to say, I like the presentation. I like it when Drew talks, but my favorite part is listening to the questions that the clients and the people who came to the conference are asking you. Usually what they uncover is actually something that you'd want to have in your presentation.
Well, exactly. The conversation continues, and that's kind of the way we take not only the weekly commentary that we do each Wednesday, but the interaction that we have with our clients, where there's a continual building, a continual education, a continual working towards something. So,
and obviously, it's nice to see them eye to eye, shake their hands, but for the person who couldn't get to those two conferences, we have one coming up again July 8th in Denver, and then, of course, there'll be future conferences. But for the person who couldn't get there, it certainly is nice to be able to listen in to the question and answer period.
And of course, we'd welcome anyone who wants to come see us. Of course, our wealth management conference is June 27th to 29th in Durango for our wealth management clients. That's followed by the July 7th to 9th conference in Denver. The presentation is actually on the 8th with dinner with our clients there on the 7th, and then Freedom Fest, Las Vegas, July 10th through the 13th. So we have some travel up and coming, and we'd love to see you there at any of those conferences. But if you cannot attend, here's just a flavor of what was discussed after the presentation, the ideas and the thoughts that were stirred as a result of the conference, and our clients' comments.
Well, you know, as we said, we had a question and answer period. And of course, out in the audience, when people are asking questions, they don't necessarily have a microphone. So we have John Loeffler with us right now, who will restate the questions so that you, the listener, after the fact, can hear the question clearly and then listen to the answer that Dave gives.
Yeah, we tried to rescue the question, so to speak.
Right.
You know, Kevin, but when we got the audio back here, you can hear Dave just fine. But yeah, the listeners are in technical jargon. They were 60 decibels down, and the room noise was so bad. You can understand them, but it's totally irritating to listen to. So,
well, and you know, John, what's interesting, too, is a lot of the people who were there probably didn't hear the question either. So this is good for all of us. Let's go to that recording.
When I was 6 years old, I walked with my dad to the bank. We were counting Krugerrands and small gold bars, and he didn't really respond well to the question, "Dad, when you die, can I have your gold?" I thought it was a reasonable question. You look at it, and what does it evoke? We're going to open up for questions that you have. We'll just go one at a time. I'll repeat the question and then answer it. Yes, in the very back.
All right, for those who couldn't hear it, this gentleman wants to know about custodial accounts and specifically about ICA's arrangement with Delaware.
With our arrangement with Delaware. Okay. Well, it's interesting. I mean, gold has been bought as an investment all over the world and stored. I mean, that's one of the problems that you have with gold is it has to be put someplace. So you can put it in the floorboards. You can put it in the freezer disguised as pork tenderloin. You can, I mean, there's lots of things that you can do with it, but most people will put it, if it's in a large quantity, particularly silver, they'll store it at a depository. In Europe, the case has been made by money managers that it's just easier to have a warehouse receipt. It's easier to have, you know, again, sort of a paper claim on a set number of ounces. And the assumption is you can always take that paper claim and turn it into physicals as and when you need to. Again, that's sort of the classic game of playing musical chairs. The assumption being it'll never be the case that you don't get a chair. Of course you'll get a chair. ABN AMRO, which is a Dutch bank, just this last, within the last 14 days, has let their clients know that the gold that they have stored will be settled in cash. So even the instances where clients were in physical metals, they've changed those accounts and are delivering in cash if you want to liquidate. So you still have your gold exposure, you still have your silver exposure, but they will liquidate you if you want to liquidate in cash instead. The arrangement that we have with Delaware Depository is radically different than that, of course. It's physical metals allocated to an individual client. And if you want to pay extra, you can have it segregated too. The difference between allocation and segregation is that on an allocated basis, we may both have silver bars, and if I don't mind my 100-ounce silver bar touching his 100-ounce silver bar, then they're allocated. He's got his, I've got mine. They just happen to be right next to each other. But if it's segregated, now I'm paying extra rent because I have a distinct zip code, so to say. I have a distinct location in the vault. And to have that space, you pay more for it. So allocation, in our opinion, is adequate. It's fine. If you're very concerned, you can pay three times the storage fees. And the reason why you're paying three times the storage fees, again, is because you're paying for airspace. Not only the space that you're taking up, but they're not going to stack anything on top of it either. So from there all the way to the ceiling, you just bought that space. Allocation is pretty reasonable in our view. And within a retirement account, it gets even better because you get segregation without paying for it. When you go to Delaware Depository, where all of our clients have their IRAs, the metal's stored, there's an individual box. On the outside of the box is a barcode. There's a recounting of what's in that box every year. So there's an audit process that happens on a continual basis, on a continual cycle. But they're able to segregate your product, keep it separate, and have it take up very little space, but distinct. It's yours, it's there, no question. I go to the facility at least once a year, usually twice a year. And Delaware Depository took over the responsibilities for HSBC. HSBC, as we've found out in recent months, does a very good job of laundering money for drug lords, but they don't do a very good job of accounting for product. And they were missing about $15 million worth of product and decided that it just wasn't the business for them, paying someone minimum wage to keep track of very valuable items. They couldn't manage the people, they couldn't manage the product, and so they quietly exited the business. Made good on all those client accounts, of course, but Delaware Depository took over that business because one thing that they do very well is logistics. Logistics, storage, they live with auditors basically all year round. Auditors from the government, they store metals for the Treasury. Auditors for all of your major banks, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, and then just regular third-party auditors who come in and for insurance purposes have to recount. So, Drew.
Two quick things. I was corrected. It's only two Olympic-sized swimming pools. So what I said before, I was grossly exaggerating. Without knowing it. It's just two Olympic-sized swimming pools. I was thinking it was three, but that shows you how little gold there really is. But to speak to your storage question with DDSC, Zurich, and Canada, a great number of our investors are interested in the semi-numismatics or these world fractional gold coins. One of the things perhaps I didn't point out the 20 francs and the 10 guilders and the sovereigns are all are very small coins. They're like 1/5 to a 1/4 ounce. So the divisibility is much, it's a great asset to have. But those coins, if stored in Delaware, are strictly segregated. You don't have a choice. We make sure that they are truly segregated. And if they're held in Canada and or Zurich, they are held under an ICA umbrella segregation so that our quality, our coins that I go to great lengths to buy, to grade, we seal them in tubes. They have serial numbers on the wires and the tubes that we do. It's very professionally done. But those can't be commingled with anyone outside the ICA family. And since I've graded them all, I've looked at them all, one tube is going to be the same as another tube, so we're okay with that. But they are physically actually there. In Delaware, they're actually in a special place with your name on them. If they're held in Canada or Zurich, they're held under an ICA. We don't have access to them, but what I'm saying is they aren't commingled with anyone else's product. We have a unique relationship with DDSC in that regard.
Yes, sir. So the question is, comparing paper gold to physical gold, what is the quantity involved, one versus the other? It varies, and is as little as 40 to 1, 40 times more paper than physical, up to 100 or 150 to 1. The most recent statistics on silver were about 140 ounces of paper, silver, traded for every one that's actually physically deliverable. So a pretty vast difference. So the question is, if we have major problems, what happens to the physical market? In futures parlance, it's what they would call backwardation, where gold that is immediately deliverable, sort of the front month, the month that you're getting ready to deliver on if you call for that contract, the price is much more expensive than any other month. I think that's what you're going to find, is that anything physical carries premiums, and anything paper trades either at spot or at a discount. Because there is the question for most investors, will it ultimately be deliverable? When I call for it, what will I get? And so if it is physical and you have it in hand, it's going to be worth more. Bird in the hand, two in the bush. Yes, sir.
What kinds of black swans are there, and what kind of triggers?
I think what would be a trigger specifically on the gold and demand for physical? I think we're watching it happen right now. I think we've already had the trigger. The trigger being Cyprus, where depositors the world over are asking the question. You don't have to be in Cyprus to realize that central planners view you as a part of the solution. They may be the problem, but you now are a part of the solution. Involuntary investment in bank stock. This is the same kind of thing that Mrs. Kirchner down in Argentina is promoting this week, which is, listen, there's $160 billion worth of money that's inside the country and outside of the country owned by Argentinians. We don't know where it is. It could be in cash or gold or whatever in a safety deposit box. We want it back in the system. If we find that you have money that's not reported and is not in the banking system, you're going to jail. But for the next 3 months, we won't throw you in jail. We'll just take it and invest it in government bonds that yield 4%. Remember that the Argentinian bond market today trades at about 13.85%. So the very generous offer that Christina is offering, it's well under market.
So, what makes us so smart to think that we're totally dealing with totally dishonest people? What makes us think we're so smart to run into problems? They're going to use everything they can to make it possible.
The question is, what makes us so smart that we think that somehow we'd be different? And, this is where I think what we don't realize is that they've already got us. Let me give you an example. Cyprus was a one-time 10% bail-in. You didn't want to contribute, but you did. You've got 90% that's sitting there in cash and 10% that's now sitting there as bank stock. One time. When Volcker was in office, he dealt with a pretty big inflationary problem, didn't he? The way he counted inflation, if you took his model and looked at today's numbers, what would we end up with? About 10%. Almost 10%. So if Volcker were in place today, he'd say, yeah, real world inflation is 10%. 10%, it's a real number, that's the way we counted it. Now granted, we mentioned earlier, they've changed the model a couple of times. They changed it in the 90s, they changed it in the 80s, and they've just changed it again. This is the debate between chained and unchained CPI. But the reality is, they've already got us. 10% inflation is an involuntary bail-in, not one time, but every year. By being able to hide the fact that there is inflation in the system, obscure that fact, put your mind to rest. You and every other creditor out there is not concerned about keeping your money in the system. Why? Because you assume that you're being treated fairly. You assume that what's being reported is accurate. You assume that they're treating you with integrity. And what we find, and you're looking for a trigger event, I think we had the trigger event with Cyprus, where bank depositors for the first time all over the world realized, wait a minute, we didn't think you could change rules like that. If they can do that, they can do anything. And that coming into a depositor's mind for the first time, it's one thing to risk your money in a speculative investment and realize that maybe it was riskier than you thought. It's very different to assume that you're sitting in cash with quote-unquote zero risk and all of a sudden see a part of your money just disappear. But you're already doing it. If Volcker's not an idiot, and I don't think he was an idiot, you may not like what he did or how he did it or have objections to this policy or that, but the way they counted inflation then, if you applied that model to today's numbers, you have 10% inflation per year, you're already in the bail-in system. 10% per year. And you think the folks in Cyprus have it bad. Would that we could only go through that once. You see? So, I mean, they could get more desperate. They could get more desperate. Yes, sir.
I'm a little bit concerned that the rumors on the internet coming from many investment gurus that the U.S. Treasury, if it finds itself unable to sell its treasury bonds at the interest rate...
There are rumors on the internet that if the U.S. can't sell treasuries, then they will force retirement accounts to be invested in treasuries, and if IRAs are converted to treasuries, how would they value the numismatic components?
Okay. You know, first of all, when thinking about retirement accounts, you know, is there a way to have a retirement account that isn't subject to seizure? And if you have a precious metals account, and there was this issue of seizure of assets, how would they determine its value? There's a couple things. One, you know, talking about Christina Kirchner, it brings to mind that there could be a forcing of an asset class into retirement accounts. What I would suggest is we back up from that a little bit and look at decisions that policymakers could make that don't have any unintended consequences for them. Politicians, at the end of the day, want to be in office, and they get voted on every 2 or 4 years. And if they make us angry enough, we might actually sort of break out of an apathetic mindset and care about being involved in politics. You know, so they run that risk that we wake up. They run the risk of waking us up. So when you think of the decisions that they might make, keep in mind that there's lower hanging fruit than retirement accounts. Pension assets are private and non-transparent. Private in the sense that, again, non-transparent. You don't know what a pension is invested in. And you've got trillions of dollars sitting in pensions, state teachers' pensions, CalPERS, you know, these kinds of pension plans that, again, what are they invested in? All that you care about is, am I going to get my pension check? They don't have to tell you every detail of what it's invested in. So, you know, there's an area where it's an asset base, or it's an asset pool that is ripe for the plucking. And all you need is a precipitating event. You need one manager of a pension to mismanage something or abscond with funds or something like that happens. And then the federal government steps in and says, you know what, here's what we define as a prudent portfolio. It has to have X in equities, X in government funds, X in, and they just kind of lay out what the asset model is. Instead of private equity, instead of hedge funds, they limit what you invest in. That's far more probable than going after your IRA, my IRA, because again, when you they've created a problem for themselves. By its very name, individual retirement account. It's not a collective retirement account. And the decisions that are being made once it's out of a 401k are entirely up to you. So there's a little bit more of an investment, a personal interest in that asset class. That makes it tough for them. So it's not to say that they couldn't go there, but I wouldn't be concerned about losing your retirement assets until they've already taken the lower hanging fruit, which would be pension assets, followed by insurance company assets, which again, vast pools of money, privately held, very easy to regulate. Very easy to regulate. So that's, you know, if you want sort of the domino effect and you're concerned about IRAs, don't be concerned at this point, but do keep your eyes and ears open because there might come a point where you should be concerned. If you're the lowest hanging fruit, It's a little bit like the guy running through the woods. He's not concerned about running from a bear as long as he's with someone who doesn't go as fast as he does. You know, if he can run faster, there's no problem. But when you're the lowest hanging fruit, then it's an issue. Metals in an IRA. They could confiscate metals, certainly. And I think it's easiest to see them as confiscatable because they're not in your possession. They're out there. They're at a depository. Easy sweep. To confiscate metals out of an IRA and not affect other IRAs, there would be some issues there. They might change the ruling on all IRAs, change the tax structure for all IRAs. But then it doesn't matter what assets you're in. I would suggest to you that you look at having physical metals in an IRA as a vital part of an overall strategy. If you're going to have precious metals in Switzerland, great. That's one arrow in your quiver. In Toronto, that's one arrow in your quiver. In your physical possession, that's another arrow in your quiver. In an IRA, strategically it's important, and here's why. Drew and I go back and forth about this all the time, the idea that gold might or might not be confiscated, like it was in 1933. For me, leaning on history, it's the idea that they needed to confiscate in 1933 to get their arms around the money supply. They controlled the money, and as soon as they controlled gold, they could print as much as they wanted. They devalued by 65% within weeks of confiscating gold. And it was the devaluation, it was the control of the currency, which they wanted, first and foremost. Only about 10% of the gold outstanding was ever handed in, which I think is fantastic. I mean, you look around this room and you think, throughout time, Americans have had no problem telling their government, when they were encroaching on our freedoms, to go pound sand. They did it then, we do it now. But that's, again, if there was a reason for them to confiscate, that's not to say they're not going to be interested in the asset or even want to discourage the ownership. They may be interested in the asset, and they may want to discourage private ownership. The easiest way for them to do that is to change the tax rules. And what that does is it puts you as a guilty party immediately. You comply, or you're in trouble. They don't have to have minions. They don't have to have an organizational structure to go safety deposit box by safety deposit box to pick up an ounce here and an ounce there. You're automatically going to give them a larger piece of the pie by default. And this is why that arrow in the quiver of having a part of your gold assets in an IRA makes so much sense to me. They could change the IRA rulings. They could change that, and I wouldn't, you know, and now all of a sudden, you know, this isn't quite as straight an arrow. But until they do, you have one pocket that's protected from a change in rules, which I would assume is almost inevitable. Now, gold at $2,000 an ounce is on their radar as an inconvenience, but there's really no battle to be fought. Gold at $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce, they either want it lower or they want to tax you more. And at $5,000 an ounce, why don't they just bump the capital gains tax rate on physical metals 50%? Why not? And with the stroke of a pen, you either comply or you're a tax dodger and you can spend time in jail for not being compliant. No minions, not any more than they already have working at the Treasury Department for the IRS.
But that argues, again, for a different definition. If bullion is in fact metals and there's something in the terms or something along the lines of a windfall profits tax that's added to or in some way penalizing people who own precious metals. If you own something that isn't defined as bullion but defined as a collectible, that again is an advantage outside the realm of a bullion or warehouse receipt or anything else that might be taxed onerously.
It's one step ahead anyway. Yeah, when you look at all of your options, you have to realize there's no perfect solution. I mean, we're living in radically challenging and very interesting times. Rules have changed and will continue to change, and so you can create dozens of what ifs and find yourself in analysis paralysis where you do nothing because you couldn't find the perfect solution. There is no perfect solution. But if you leave as many of your options open as possible, If you assume that, yes, I've got medals in my physical possession, I've got medals in my IRA, I've got medals in Switzerland, I've got medals, you know, and again, we're just talking about a portion of someone's assets. You shouldn't be 100% in medals, clearly, but that's the topic du jour. If you've done all those things, something may change and you still have a plan B, a plan C, a plan D. And as McIlvaineys, it's just kind of the way we think. My dad was a Boy Scout, I was a Cub Scout, I kind of got bored with it, but we create our own adventures, and I was outpacing the Cub Scout mom at the time. So, but we do think in terms of plan B's and C's and D's, and I think that makes sense. Again, is there a perfect solution or scenario? No, but we do the absolute best we can with the information we have, and recognize that you may have to make some mid-course corrections as time goes on. Yes, sir.
Is that the tax issue. And I think that we can put it in an IRA. And if things hide in an IRA, I don't report it, it just goes on and on and on. So if my precious metals is maybe hiding in an IRA over a period of time, and I sell it, it's going to possibly be at an income level. But when it comes to the physicals, you know, there's diversity, you're going to have both. The physicals, they can tax, okay, we don't like people have this. In a way, confiscated is through taxes. So we might find the physical is taxed 40% of the sale, but the stuff that's in the IRA is all commingled with the IRA. So that might be taxed at the income level
when it's sold. Right. So you still have that protection. And that's where strategically, we've had a number of clients say, hey, listen, I'm so concerned about confiscation of the IRA assets that I'm going to go ahead and take delivery. I'm going to pay the hit now. At least I know what my tax hit is today. And I, you know, income tax rates could be 90% at the top rate before all is said and done. I'd rather pay it today than pay it tomorrow. Well, I mean, what you're doing is you're taking in that with that logic and saying you know more about the future than you actually do. We just don't know. So with what you do know, absolutely, make the best plans that you can. And I think an IRA is a good fit for that. The other thing that allows you to do, and you know, you talk to Tori about this, you could talk to Kevin about this, or anyone at our company. There's times when one of the metals is undervalued relative to the other. I'll just give you an example. Throughout time, how many ounces of silver have the same value as 1 ounce of gold? 1 ounce of gold should equal how many ounces of silver? In ground at 16, so if you're talking to a geologist, then the in ground ratio is 16. As it trades in the open market, and actually the stuff that they've been pulling out of the ground is closer to 12 to 14 in the last year or two. But as it's traded through time in the open market as a currency, as a part of a monetary system, it's closer to 30 to 1, the ratio, 30 to 1. So, you know, as it traded in the market during the Hunt Brothers days, we did get to 15 to 1. But that was the massive spike given the position that the Hunt Brothers had already taken and the massive people who came in right after that and drove the price up. When we got to that extreme, we were at a 15 to 1 ratio at the peak. Normal relationship is 30 to 1. Where are we at today? 61 to 1. So inside an IRA, it's the perfect example of with that ratio, you definitely want to own a little bit more silver than gold. Over a long period of time, being able to go back and forth from one to the other, and again, not have a tax consequence because you get to buy and sell on a tax-deferred basis, I don't want to give up my ability to organically grow the number of ounces that I own. And you can do that inside of an IRA without tax consequences. You can do it outside of an IRA, but you have tax consequences when you make the changes. So that's something that we've done very effectively over the last 40 years. Yes, ma'am. What happens to the value of gold if the government has an outright default on the debt? It's a good question. I don't know exactly. I think we can assume that if we can't find anyone to fund our debt, if we're having a crisis in the bond market, we're also having a crisis in the currency market. For the only hesitation on my part is because I don't know which comes first. a crisis in the currency market or the bond market? Does one precipitate the other? Do they happen at the same time? So when you ask what happens to gold if we default on our debt, in all probability, the price of gold goes through the roof. I think that we're not going to default, because there's no reason for us to default. Let me explain that a little bit. Contrary to countries that borrow, little countries that borrow from big countries, you borrow on the terms of the bigger countries. We're the biggest. So even though we borrow the most, we still get to borrow on our own terms. We borrow in US dollar terms. This is why creditors need to be paying attention to what we do with our currency. Because unlike Venezuela, unlike Argentina, unlike Ecuador, unlike Mexico, when they go to the international markets to borrow, it's either going to be in pound sterling or US dollars, typically. Typically, it's denominated in a foreign currency, which means that if they begin to devalue their currency, if they don't manage their money right, all of those IOUs not only have to be paid back, but with a devalued currency, it becomes a hurdle. That much harder to pay back. It takes that much more of the currency to pay back. Does that make sense? So it's easier for a country that doesn't denominate its IOUs in its own currency to default. But when you denominate all of your debt in your own currency, it's easier to inflate. So we have a subtle form of default already. And again, this is where massaging perception, creating a PR campaign that doesn't allow people to believe that, you know, there is no inflation. I mean, this is very much like the Wizard of Oz. Who is the man behind the scene? What kind of realities are we creating? Smoke and mirrors. The great power of Oz, right? And it's just a little man from Kansas behind the scene. That's it. But that's what we're doing with our currency. We are devaluing our currency because it makes no sense for us to default. It makes no sense. I mean, that's you can have wars started. You can end trade relations. There's consequences to default. Not as much as you'd think, actually, but there are still consequences. In most instances, when Latin and South American countries defaulted, the ones that defaulted were the first ones to recover economically because it was like getting a clean slate. Argentina is a classic case in point of a country in South America that tried to honor their debts and has been mired with more economic travails as a consequence of being responsible. Everybody else who's defaulted instantly got to start over. And the credit markets usually lent them any amount of money they wanted within 4 or 5 years. Very short memory in the credit markets. We're defaulting today. We are inflating today. And that's why this inflation number and this manipulation of models is absolutely critical to the game that they're playing. If I were in Washington, this is what I would do. Because we're in too deep. Not as in, I'm not going to Washington, I'm not interested. But you understand, just pragmatically. Not ideally, but pragmatically, it makes sense what they're doing. It absolutely makes sense. If you take an inflation rate of 2%, call it 2%, but actually run it at 4%, if you run that as a time value of money calculation, you're going to cut your debt in half in a 16-year period. So all they need to do is buy time. Don't you panic. Just continue to buy. Be a happy little consumer. And let's just operate this game for 16 years, and all of our debt is cut in half over that 16-year period just by toggling inflation by 2%. If they can run it at more than that, then our debt's not an issue at all. You see? But who should really care about this subtle form of default? It should be our foreign creditors. And so, again, we come back to that issue of what is the precipitating event for panic in the bond market or panic in the dollar? When our creditors feel like they have enough insulation from the consequences of losing us as a business partner, they're not quite there yet. But over the next 3 or 4 years, do you see enough of those emerging markets develop relationships where they don't need us? And China's doing their best. You know, 17 different bilateral trade agreements to circumvent the US dollar as the middleman currency last year. Last year. Or more the year before that. There'll be more this year. And what that's doing is it's changing the plumbing. It's changing the plumbing in terms of the way international trade is settled. We used to be the middleman currency. In other words, invoices between the Japanese and the Chinese settled in U.S. dollar terms, which required that the Japanese and the Chinese both keep dollars on deposit to settle that business. It's a very enviable position to be in. They're redoing the plumbing right now. They're redoing the plumbing, which means that the demand for dollars, which has been taken for granted by the folks in Washington, it's steady there because all they've done is change the plumbing. They haven't changed the flow. I mean, it's one thing to retrofit a house and then ultimately go from the old pipes to the new pipes. We're still on the old pipes. They're just putting in the new ones, and I think it's a matter of 12, 18, 24 months before you begin to see a change in liquidity flow and then a real impact to the dollar. At a fascinating conference about 3 weeks ago in New York City, some heavyweights, you'd recognize all the names. The consensus was 50 to 60% devaluation of the dollar. The only difference of opinion was whether or not it's 0 to 3 years or 3 to 5. At any time, it could happen. Tomorrow morning, 0 to 3. What's the precipitate ending event? We don't know. Or 3 to 5, where there's still a little bit more water that needs to go under the bridge, deterioration in the bond market. Bill Gross this morning says we have, as of April, ended a 30-year bond bull market, his opinion. The question is, did Buffett move out of the bond market in the last couple of days? I don't know. Yes, Marcia.
The lady wants to know what the age and demographic makeup of ICA conference attendees are.
The demographics of when we're giving presentations and whatnot, as I travel around meeting with people, what do we see? It's pretty similar to this. I think you're dealing with something that's psychological as well as demographic, and it is that at a certain age you can look back and criticize and say, you know, this is the way it was, and it's not that way now. And with whether it's some degree of nostalgia or, you know, conservatism, wishing that it was today the way it was, then, you know, there's a looking back. For a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old, there is no looking back. They haven't begun to live. They don't have anything behind them. They only have what's ahead. And so what I find is that when I'm talking to young people, they don't have a frame of reference which ties history into it. They don't have their own history, and unfortunately, today's educational system, they don't have much of an awareness of history beyond, you know, personal first-person experience either. But I mean, I think that's a part of it. Is it'll be the exception. Someone who can look forward to tomorrow, whatever it brings. You know, and I'll put myself in that same category. I'm sure you can imagine what it would be like to sit at the dinner table with Don McIlvaney every night. Have any of you read his newsletter? Have any of you had to purposefully either stay away from whiskey or high ledges or, you know, honey, lock me in tonight. This is not good. Well, this was dinner table conversation every night. And so I think there's a part of me that can appreciate, you know, what is tomorrow? What's on the horizon? You know, with three young kids, are we looking at the end of America, or are we looking at something just different than we've known before? A new America, maybe we like it, maybe we don't. I don't know. It's difficult to think about a terminal state at a young age. And we're dealing with terminal states when we're dealing with our economy today. We're dealing with terminal states when we're talking about deterioration in politics. It's very disturbing to me that we can have drones flying over us, taking pictures of us, recording us. You know, the influence of technology and big government. If you read International Affairs, this month's article on big data. Big data and big government. I mean, you know, all of your Google searches, all of your purchasing habits. You are a profile. Whether you're on Facebook or not, you're already a profile. And the idea of getting inside your head, they can do that. I mean, grocery store chains have been doing that for years. That's why they love that little loyalty card, because they know what to put on sale and then who's going to be buying it and who's not going to be buying it in any particular season, in any particular day of the week. The people who shop on Tuesday mornings only buy green tomatoes. And they know it categorically. And that's why green tomatoes are on sale on Tuesday mornings, but not on Wednesday afternoons. That, you know, where we're going is frankly very disturbing. But it's not entirely disturbing. And I think one of the books that we've read in the office, I'd encourage you to read as well, individually, as couples, as a family, as a conversation starter, William Strauss and Neil Howe co-authored a book in 1996 called The Fourth Turning. The Fourth Turning is the title of it. And The Fourth Turning looks at 600 years of British and American history. And in that 600-year period, they, as demographers, as sociologists, see a pattern. And that pattern is that roughly every 100 to 120 years, something goes terribly wrong. And there's a social conflict which is either resolved internally via some sort of civil war or externally where it's, you know, the blame game is played and you go shoot your neighboring country instead of just your neighbor. I mean, it's just this... I'm using crude terms, but I mean, this is the issue of every 100 years, they're basically saying four generations go by and you've lost your collective minds again. Neil Howe and William Strauss. But it's important because one of the things that they point out is, if you think of what they call turnings in terms of seasons, winter is a dead period. And it's really no fun. I mean, if you're thinking of your own mortality, you're thinking about cultural life and death, you're talking about the death of a culture. The beauty of winter is that it's followed by spring. In every period of renewal, spiritual renewal and rebirth culturally for the last 600 years has followed one of these intense periods of struggle and frustration and social and moral decay. So, and I think this is where on an intergenerational basis you can look and not be afraid of what's happening today or be frustrated with what's happening today. I would say this, and I don't mean to be offensive at all, because I do like plan Bs and Cs and Ds, the alphabet, if you will, of options. But we talk to a lot of people as we travel, and the idea that somehow if I just leave the United States and move to Argentina, good luck with that. Talk about moving from the frying pan to the fire. Christina will cook you and eat you for breakfast. That's the president, Kirchner. Where do we go? I mean, is there a place that we should go? Is it Ecuador? Is it Panama? Is it, you know, Canada? It's a worldwide issue. It's a worldwide issue. I don't know that you're going to be better anywhere else. So you have some disadvantages if you go someplace else, either linguistic disadvantages. Otto Scott was a family friend, a historian who lived up here in the Northwest, and he used to say, David, if you don't speak the language, you're reduced to the level of a child. So, that, I mean, unless you're bilingual, you've just eliminated a lot of places where you might want to reside, other than sort of on a short-term vacation. So where do we go? This is just fine. Where are we at? At a very awkward period in history. And it's been awkward just like this at other times. And you know, what I would challenge you to do is think about your kids, think about your grandkids, think about your community, think about your church, think about the people that you care about most, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, and realize that you may have more answers than they do. You may have been more curious or frankly just of a personality bent that is more concerned in asking questions than some other people do, or have to this point. And they're going to be asking questions, and they're going to need insight, and they're going to need to know what to do. And it's going to be harder to take action under a period of stress than the way that you've been able to approach this, which is without really being under stress or strain to speak of, just sort of seeing a slow process of decay in the economy, or socially, or culturally, politically. You've been able to make decisions, but again, it's not sort of like in a firefight making decisions. Now you're talking about friends and family members who haven't given two thoughts to current events, who are asking questions or will, wonder what to do, and be under pressure, and you're going to be the only person who can give them guidance. You see?
Yeah, just coming from across the country. The whole family doesn't even have a clue. mean, out of the people in this room, there's probably, it's the top 10% of what's at least aware that something's happening. Rest of them are just in their own world. It's amazing.
Yeah, very few people are aware that there's anything of a negative nature. Why? Because, well, if you read the news media, they'll tell you we've already recovered. The economy is in recovery. Never mind the fact that we've got a record number of people on food stamps and food assistance programs, 47.7 million people on food assistance. The unemployment numbers continue to improve, largely on two bases. One, the labor participation rate is at levels we haven't seen since 1979. So, you know, you calculate the number of people who are unemployed on the total people who are employed, who have jobs at all, and if you have people leaving the labor force, it distorts the number. Or we also have the 1990 shift, a recategorization. Everyone knows what a discouraged worker is, don't you? Discouraged worker? If you have been unemployed for greater than 12 months, you fall off the rolls. You're no longer considered unemployed. You go into a new category called the discouraged worker category. Doesn't mean you have a job. But when you look at moving from 7.7 to 7.6 to 7.5, and that number is improving, and that's the evidence that's proffered for being in an economic recovery, this is not myself, this is not Drew, this is not Dave Burgess, this is not my dad saying, you know, there's a dark cloud in every blue sky. This is saying these numbers are played with. They're manipulated. It's not reality. The question is, are part-time jobs counted as full?
They're counting part-time jobs, 30 hours a week, as a full-time job.
Part-times factor in to the jobs equation. The quality of jobs are not factored in. So you could leave a $50,000 a year job or a $100,000 a year job and be flipping hamburgers. And it's, you know, the qualitative differences aren't factored in. But again, all this to say, we think that we are in the progress of experiencing great change. There's a great opportunity in that. Great opportunity for you to lead. You may not consider yourself a leader. That's fine. Some of the best leaders were never volunteering themselves. Does that make sense? And I think one of the things that Strauss and Howe's book makes clear is that on a generational basis, you can look at who the leaders are today, and you know they're not going to be the leaders who get us out of this. They were the leaders that got us into this mess. And it is great crisis that brings about a different mindset, a different quality of problem solving, and a different kind of person to lead. So when you think of your kids, when you think of your grandkids, when you think of, you know, the neighbor down the street who's 17 years old and asking really good questions, encourage them, because you have no idea what they can do. You have no idea who they are. Yes, ma'am.
What is your advice for young people?
What is my advice for young people just starting out financially? John Templeton was a brilliant investor, Sir John Templeton. He started the Templeton Mutual Funds, sold them to Franklin for another mutual fund company for hundreds of millions of dollars, was asked the same question shortly before he passed away. This was 2004, 2005. Young man sat down with him and just said, you know, what should I do? Very easy answer. He said, well, what's the Chinese savings rate? He didn't know. So he said, 51%. I can guarantee you, you'll be success financially if you can save more than the Chinese. Maybe that's not reasonable, but certainly 10% or 15% or 20% or 30%. I mean, wealth is what we've been told what wealth is. And you have to decide pretty early on whether or not you agree with that. Is it having a car that you have payments on? Is it having a house that you have payments on? Is it, I mean, the trappings of wealth is what's been presented to us as wealth. And that's not wealth. Savings and investment have created a country that is massively successful. Savings and investment. It means that you have to work harder than you expected and save more than you really want to. Live below your means, not at your means. Because if you can live below your means, then you have the ability to save. And on that basis, you have the ability to see resources grow. But the one thing you have to have is time. So a work ethic, an ability to choose to not spend everything that you make gives you the ability to save and then give yourself time. Rome wasn't built in a day, neither will your future financial success. But being diligent about saving 20%, 30%. If you set a budget, something as simple as living within your means, knowing what you need, scaling it back a bit, what does that allow you to do as you make certain professional benchmarks and now are compensated more? Live within your means. Don't bump up what you're spending. It just means that you actually very quickly can get to that 50% savings rate. And then investing and allowing there to be time factored in terms of a financial, that's just financial advice. You have to have time. You know, I think the other thing that I would say is that nobody today really thinks about wealth intergenerationally. I mean, everybody does if they're thinking about a will or a trust or whatnot, but nobody gets started early enough. Part of the reason I started, and I mentioned to you the IRAs for my kids, is because I'm not worried about my retirement. I'm worried about their retirement. You know why? 60 years of growth is what they get. 60 years of growth. If you understand the power of compound interest and just a small amount of growth, the one variable you have to have to grow assets effectively is time. You can't wait till tomorrow. You cannot wait till tomorrow. And better yet, if you can be investing for the next generation and train them to do the very same thing. The other thing it does, and this is a hope, this is obviously theoretical, but my hope is that my kids never look at money as something that serves their own ends and their own purposes, but it's for others. It's for the next generation. It's for people in need. It has nothing to do with them. They're stewards along the way. They work hard, they save lots, they think about other people, and if they amass great wealth, it doesn't corrupt them. I hope it won't corrupt them. I hope. But that sense of otherness is pretty important. And it's a hope and a prayer that I can train them to think about the next generation from a young age. Yes, ma'am.
You happen to mention getting a report on our banks. What are the things you use the credit union out of that?
We mentioned banks, and the question is, can we get the same kind of rating on credit unions? There is no ratings for credit unions because there's not the same kind of mandatory reporting from credit unions because they're not FDIC insured and there's not that regular reporting. So as far as I know, do they really? Thank you. I wasn't aware of that. That must be in the last year or two that they've changed that. Yeah, so what we do is we spend quite a lot of money to have the Weiss service on every institution in the country. We'll expand our subscription to include credit unions. So give us a week or two and we'll have that for you. That's good news. Thank you. Yes, sir. Would we cover exit strategies? Yeah, absolutely. I think this is one of the most important things I think y'all could be thinking about right now. The question is, in a bull market, assets appreciate. In a bear market, assets tend to do the opposite, depreciate. When we get to, or at least somewhat close to, the end of a bull market, one, can you recognize that? Two, can you begin implementing a plan that helps you reduce your exposure? And so exit strategies for us, I would use a different word. I would say a reduction strategy. And the reason I would say a reduction strategy is because what I want to do, this goes back to sort of an intergenerational theme, I want to create assets that have zero cost bases. Let me expand on that for you. If I took $100,000 and put it into gold, and through the course of a bull market it's worth $300,000, it's grown in value. I have my original investment of $100,000, I have $200,000, which is excess gain, that's profit. I'd like to pair that back to my original investment of $100,000. I'm extracting twice the value of my original investment to take and go do something else with. But what I keep in gold, I'm essentially keeping with a zero cost basis. You tend to think about assets differently when you have no money in them. Does that make sense? It takes time. It takes decades, even generations, to create an entire balance sheet where everything in it has a zero cost basis. but where you've effectively managed wealth through bull and bear markets in tangible assets, through bull and bear markets in paper assets, through bull and bear markets in real estate, but where you've effectively captured the growth and then reoriented that capital to more productive ends. So, you know, when I think of a reduction strategy, it's not exiting metals, it's deciding how much of the metals that I have today will be intergenerational assets. How much will be an intergenerational asset? So that's just more of a philosophical position. What that looks like is in how you do that in relation to metals is going to surprise you. It has very little to do with the price of the metals themselves. Probably wondering, well, is gold going to 3,000? Is it going to 5,000? Is it going to 10,000 an ounce? What about silver? 60? 120? 250? I mean, what would be the ultimate prices for the metals? And that's, you know, pure speculation. No one knows where we're going to end, in part because we don't know what's going to happen with our currency. You see, I mean, you remember that chart that I had up there of the gold ounce priced in German marks? If you're trying to capture the top of the market and in gold, you know, your gold ounces in German mark terms, let's say you're in Germany in 1919 and gold's tripled in 1 year. And you're thinking, I can't believe this. Any prudent money manager would take gains right now. I've tripled my money. And then you quadruple your money. And then you quintuple your money. And then, I mean, the numbers start to get insane because your gains aren't really gains. They're commentary on the death of that currency. Can you ever afford to be out of precious metals? I would say physical metals, no, because you're dealing with an insurance policy. You're dealing with something that protects you against the demise of a currency. But you can reasonably transfer real assets to other real assets, irrespective of the price of the metals. And that has to do with relative value. How many houses does my gold portfolio buy? How many shares of General Electric or Johnson & Johnson does my portfolio buy? How about commercial or light industrial spaces? You fancy yourself as a fixer-upper. How about a multifamily apartment complex? If today your gold portfolio buys you a fourplex, tomorrow I would guess that your gold portfolio buys you three or four. So it's on a relative value basis that you're looking at capturing as much purchasing power as possible. You want to capture the purchasing power, the price is almost irrelevant. And you have to remove price from the equation, both when you purchase and when you sell, and be looking at value. What are you getting? Price is what you pay, value is what you get. And we've seen this just from 2005 to the present. The average single family home has gone from, you know, 227,000, 230,000 to, you know, let's call it 200,000. Some depreciation on the national average. The ounces that it would have taken in 2005 to buy that single family home would today buy you four single family homes. And my guess is that we're probably mostly done with the depreciation of housing, but we're not done with the appreciation in gold. If you have both of those things working for you in tandem, now you're talking about a multiplier effect where your gold is buying not one, but four, not four, but 10 single family homes. So again, the price is irrelevant to me, only because it's more or less currency noise. I could get all excited about a $10,000 gold price, but not if it's going to a million. And see, it's tough to call. Why would gold go to a million? I mean, you're again talking about currency extinction. Gold in mark terms went into the trillions. Does that seem absurd? It's very poor management of the money system. But the opportunities that you had in that context, there was a gentleman by the name of Hugo Stennis. Does anyone know that name? Stennis, S-T-I-N-N-E-S. Look it up. Stennis went to the British shipyards and paid £3,500 to have a steamship made so that he could, as someone who was a coal miner, take his coal down the river. The benefit of taking his coal down the river is that he got to sell it to the French, he got to sell it to three or four different countries. So when the hyperinflation came in 1919, he had something that no one else in the coal business had, a source of foreign currency revenues. And so as the mark was being destroyed, he had an alternative currency, and it wasn't being destroyed. And it allowed him to buy over 3,000 companies in a matter of about 4 years. Foreign currency alternatives, you can do that yourself. If you don't have revenue coming in from a foreign operation, you can have part of your savings denominated in gold and silver and accomplish the same thing. I'm not promising that you can buy 3,000 companies. That's where cash flow does matter. He had great cash flow. It was a basic business, a little bit of money, and he was buying assets for pennies on the dollar. Pennies on the dollar. So again, it's that value of what did he pay for the company? Well, he had something that no one else had, something that had maintained value in the context of the German hyperinflation. He had taken a part of his money and basically moved it outside of a decaying, outside of a dying system. And you know, as you were suggesting earlier, the difference between this period in time and any other that we've seen in history is the periods of inflation have been localized. They've been just limited. Never before have we had an entire currency system that didn't have some grounding, some reference value. And this is what we lost in 71, and it's taken us some time to actually get to a dangerous place. But when we came off the gold standard in 1971, completely, ended the Bretton Woods period. Gold and the dollar were in the international markets treated as one because we had 8,000 tons. Actually, through the 50s and 60s and up to the late 60s, we had 22,000 tons of gold. And this arrangement was gold and greenbacks are the same. They have equal value. So if we owe you, if the United States owes you something, your choice, ounces or greenbacks, we don't care. They're the same. Very bold. Well, it was actually the French that figured it out first. I'll take it in gold. Jacques Rouff was the advisor to de Gaulle. Jacques Rouff, great book. If you guys want to read, this is fantastic. This is a classic. Jacques Rouff's book, The Monetary Sin of the West. So Jacques Rouff was the financial attaché for the French during the British devaluation in 1931. By the time the 60s roll around, he says, I've seen this before. I know what a devaluation looks like. I know what's getting ready to happen in the United States, and we better get our gold. I am telling you, do this. And de Gaulle stalled and stalled and stalled, and finally, Rouff started publishing his ideas in newsprint all around the world. And de Gaulle said, I'm going to get embarrassed if I don't listen. And he listened, and he started taking the gold. And they went from 22,000 tons at Fort Knox, quote-unquote, to about the 8,000 that we have today. And they had to close the gold window. Nixon had to close the gold window because the world was calling our bluff. They saw that the dollar had no value, that they were being treated unfairly, as if, you know, we're doing the same thing now. Only we don't even have a promise of gold on the table. I'm not exactly sure what they expect to get from us. But this is what was happening then. This is what was happening then.
Was our recovery from the inflationary crisis of 1980 brought about by Paul Volcker's high interest rates, or was it brought about by Henry Kissinger's agreement with the King of Saudi Arabia to give a commodity backing to the U.S. dollar with Saudi Arabian oil?
You're spot on. I mean, there was a number of factors. One was that Reagan was willing to take what was a $900 billion national debt and triple it in a very short period of time. It drove David Stockman nuts, and he left the administration in protest. Left or was asked to leave, I don't know. But he was making a big kerfluffle about the fact that this was fiscally irresponsible, and you came in thinking that, you know, everyone came in thinking that you were going to be conservative, quote-unquote, when it came to economics. And you've just joined the ranks of the enemy. So Stockman was shuffled on out. But that was a part of it. You know, you had massive stimulus into the economy via deficit spending. And at the same time, you've got Kissinger signing up a sweetheart deal where oil's traded in U.S. dollar terms. And this comes back to this notion of what happens when we lose reserve currency status. Or even more subtly, we don't lose reserve currency status, but we lose being the middleman currency in transactions. What we gained under Kissinger, we can certainly give up again. And that's why these bilateral trade agreements, this is not pie in the sky. This is not if it happens then. It's already happening. It's already happening. So the clock is ticking. I look at my bank statement every month, and I say, why would I want this just sitting here? And understand, this is not a sales pitch. I look at my bank savings and I think, Ben Bernanke has no respect for the value of what I've earned. There's no value. Does not appreciate it, realizes that it's expendable as far as he's concerned, and he's targeting 2% inflation. A target of 2% inflation means that everything that you save in your lifetime is going to be cut in half. That's 2%, and that's good monetary policy. We're going to take half. I mean, if you just wanted to cut the garbage, a 2% targeted inflation rate is going to every man, woman, and child and saying, for all your life's effort, just understand we're going to keep half, and that doesn't even, you know, we're not talking about the death tax. Fifty-year period, longer than that, on a 2% basis. So, yeah, I mean, I struggle to look at a bank statement and think, why am I leaving this vulnerable? Is John Paulson, does that name ring a bell? Paulson, when he made a couple $1 billion shorting the subprime market, drives home one evening and he's asking himself the question: now with my $3.5 to $4 billion in cash, what currency am I going to denominate it in? It's a great question. It's a great question, because when he did his homework, looked at the Australian dollar, he looked at the Norwegian kroner, he looked at the euro, he looked at the British pound, he looked at the yen, he looked at the US dollar, and he said, what I see is the management teams behind every one of them. And I've got to have confidence in management to have confidence in the shares. Because essentially every one of these currency units is like a share representing management. So no, I'm not interested. And, you know, I mean, this is one of the sort of modern day investors who's interested in gold. He's denominated his savings in real money. He's denominated his savings in gold. Did he buy it because he was speculating in commodities like he would orange juice contracts or pork bellies? It's a currency position, and it's a transnational currency position. It's beyond borders. He could care less what the Fed does. He could care less what the ECB does. He could care less what Karuda does. And I think that would be a helpful perspective for you to take. How have I denominated my savings? How have I denominated my assets? Who's managing them? Whether I've given them permission or not. Yes, ma'am.
So you've got the old man that's just the mattress with $1 million. Is that a better way to put your money away than in the bank? And if you don't have an IRA and you're just doing a minimal investment,
Well, so there's a couple questions there. If you're a man or woman that has $1 million that you just want to stuff on the mattress, you know, is that the best thing to do? Part one. Part two is, in a metals position, what makes more sense? Semi-numismatics. We'll get to the gold allocation in a minute. You know, they get their 2% because that's what's, you're losing purchasing power by that amount. And it doesn't matter if it's hidden in the mattress or in a bank. They're going to get their 2% via inflation. You don't have to be in the banking system to pay the price of inflation. Your money making less, unless you have it in gold and silver or rare art, or 1982 is a good year for Chateau Lafite. You can store it in real things. You can store it in real things and sort of step out of that system. The problem is when you take cash out of the system, you have to figure out how to get it back in. This is what the folks in Cyprus have struggled with. If you are a Cypriot depositor, now you have the opportunity to take out $100,000. Of course, 10% is locked up, but you decide, you know, I'm not playing any games. They said it was a one-time deal. I think they're coming back for more. Take it all out. You have special reporting for every transaction, every cash transaction you have over a certain threshold. And you can't take the money outside of the country. You've got capital controls already in place in Spain and in Cyprus and in Greece. Taking money in and out of the country is an impossibility in scale. And then spending it on any scale, they've limited both what the person spending and the person receiving the funds can receive. I mean, it's gridlock for the business community. Transactions over 3,000, there's a whole set of paperwork that has to be filed. So if you take the money out and have it sitting in cash, now you have to prove that you're not a money launderer. Now you have to prove that you're not a drug lord. Now that you have to prove that, well, where did it come out of? If it came out of the banking system, fine. But we need to prove that you don't still owe more taxes on it. I mean, it puts a strange burden on you to have cash outside of the system. And, you know, gold is and always has been a way that people preemptively just say, then fine. If there's consequences all over the place for me doing what I want to do, then I'm going to be out. Not out of just the banking system, but out of the currency system. These are too many games and there's too much complexity and it's all stacked against me. It's like going to Vegas and being treated, like you'd think that you're being treated with fair odds. Everything's stacked against you. The house wins all the time. The house wins. That's what we're seeing. When we talked about a precipitating event, that was Cyprus. Cyprus was the first time people saying, what do I do then? If I'm out of the banks, do I go to the mattress? If I'm in the mattress and I want to take it out of the mattress, if I buy a set of dining furniture and it costs me $5,000, I've got to justify where the cash came from. I mean, very rapidly, we're moving to a... This will be interesting. The next 3-4 years are going to be really interesting.
You can't just charge it and then pay the charge bill.
Oh, you can. You can, but there's limitations on credit card charges, too. There's limitations in terms of what you can ring up on a credit card, too. Same as a cash transaction. There are limits for vendors receiving payment. I think $3,000 was a threshold, or buying something. Now, that brings us to the point of an allocation of metals. It's one of the reasons why we like the European fractional coins. Pick up any fractional coin. But here's the thing. If you're buying 10-ounce American Eagle gold coins, you pay a fabrication premium on the 10-ounce gold American Eagle, which is the same premium that you'd pay for a fractional gold coin that's 120 years old. You tell me what you want. Something that was minted yesterday that you pay a premium for, or something that was minted 120 years ago and isn't going to be remade for the same premium. So for us, it's been a very pragmatic approach to, if we ever had to spend our gold, we want it in a spendable form. A kilo bar is hard to spend, unless you're talking about buying an apartment. Or buy, you know, I mean, the larger the bar, the larger the item you have to buy with it. And so for practicality's sake, you know, silver's easy. Silver's you can spend silver a lot easier than gold, but it takes a lot of space. So if you're going to have a large amount of gold or any quantity of gold to speak of, the more divisible the better. A 1-ounce coin is better than a 10-ounce bar. A 10-ounce bar is better than a kilo bar. A kilo bar is better than a 100-ounce or a 400-ounce bar. Why? Because of its divisibility, because it gives you flexibility. And it sounds odd, but that does factor into what we like and what we don't like. You know, when we look at the U.S. $20 gold pieces as an example, those are semi-numismatic coins. Those are coins that trade at a premium, and based on supply and demand, that premium either can be a little or a lot. We're not talking about commission. We're just talking about what it costs to, you know, again, basis supply and demand. You could have something trading at 30% over the spot price or 130%. Same item, but if it's in demand, you have to pay that to own it. The reason I like coins like that for at least a part of a portfolio, in that kind of permanent portfolio, you remember I was talking about the kids and their IRAs being able to trade back and forth between gold and silver? It allows me to approach a permanent position in gold and silver with a dynamic element in it, where based on those premium expansions and contractions, I can own something today that has low to no premium, sell it tomorrow with a high premium, and end up with more ounces, and wait and come right back into the same item when it has a low premium again. So there's different ways to approach the older coins. Yes, they're non-reportable. When you liquidate them, you still have to pay your taxes. That's a no-brainer. But there's a different set of reporting requirements. So privacy is an element. That's not what matters to me. What matters to me is having that dynamic nature. I'll give you an example of why. The numbers are easy on this one. It's why I can share them off the top of my head. One of my clients in Southern California sent me $500,000 for a silver purchase. We bought bags of halves. This was in 2007. $500,000, the bags were about $10,000 each. We bought 50 bags. 2008 rolled around. The premiums on the bags jumped to about 35%. We came out of those bags and went into silver bars. Premiums on the bags dropped. We have all these extra free ounces. And we go back and we buy the same bags that we originally bought and then sold and then are now buying again. We went from 50 bags to 65 bags. Now he's got 15 bags, that's 715 ounces per bag, 15 bags for free. And we're just in the process now with about a 15% premium. It's not as healthy as it was. It was closer to 35, but we'll do that again and should net when we come back around an extra 5,000 ounces for the account. That kind of a trade isn't possible if you step in and just say, hey, I want to own silver. I want to own the cheapest possible silver. Give me a 1,000-ounce silver bar. There's nothing dynamic. You can play the price on the basis of a 1,000-ounce silver bar, but there's nothing dynamic to it. So a well-constructed portfolio is going to have bullion in it, bars, coins, silver, gold, a combination. It's going to have semi-numismatic coins to give that long-term growth dynamic. Again, it's an opportunity to trade something if you're looking at metals as something that's going to be permanent. If it's not permanent, then don't fuss with it. If it's not permanent, if owning physical metals is just a trade on the basis of a price movement, buy the cheapest stuff possible and move on. Buy a kilo bar, buy a 1,000-ounce silver bar, and call it good. Commissions are smaller, your bid-ask spread is tighter, all of that makes the most sense. What you're never going to end up with is, in a permanent portfolio, the ability to trade up ounces. So when it comes to silver, I only buy junk bags. Now, I'm a seller today, not a buyer, because of the premium. And that would be the question, as you're working with the guys in our office to figure out, okay, well, if I'm putting together a portfolio today, but I do want a growth dynamic, then this is important. Then it's going to be a different portfolio than somebody who says, all I want is a silver and gold exposure. I prefer gold over silver because I'm going to take it into my possession and I don't want to hassle with the weight of silver. Question, how are taxes handled on those extra 15 bags? It depends on how it's done. So if I'm moving gold to silver, it's not a like-for-like exchange. You're moving categories. If it's silver to silver, you're talking about the equivalent of a 1031 or a 1035 exchange. If you want to keep it incredibly clean, you can use an escrow agent, and that escrow agent can take the proceeds from one transaction, forward them on to the purchase of the next transaction, so that no money is remitted to you, in which case the IRS, under an audit, has no question about what you've just done. Moving from silver to silver. Silver to silver. Silver to silver is fine, gold to gold is fine, but when you start moving outside of that, it's in the 1960s and 70s, there was a lot more latitude, only because the IRS wasn't as keen. There hadn't been as many cases tried where these things had been sort of developed or sussed out. So here's me, non-accountant, non-tax advisor. I'll defer to an accountant and a tax advisor anytime. The way we transact the business is to be able to provide that information to the escrow company and or the tax advisor who's handling the reporting, so that they can do that. With most deferrals, when you're talking about a 1035, as in the case of insurance, or 1031 in real estate, you're deferring gains. Ultimately, you have gains to pay, but if you're trading up in a house, or you're trading multifamily to multifamily, and you pick up an extra two units, at the end of the line, you're going to pay your taxes. The only thing that a like-for-like exchange does for you is buy you some time to grow until that final day. Well, here's the thing. The beauty of thinking about assets on an intergenerational basis is the way you structure assets, you leave something to someone, they're going to get a step up in basis. So if you can create a portfolio of things that, you started with $100,000 and it's now $300,000, you move on to greener pastures with $200,000, you keep the original investment with a zero cost basis. Theoretically, it's a zero cost basis, but for tax purposes, you're going to have to assign some value to it. Except that when you die, you've got to step up. You've got to step up in basis. So, I mean, you're never going to see that step up if you're not thinking about an intergenerational transfer. But if you begin to think about some of those things and plan for them years or decades ahead, or just adopt it as a family practice, it makes a big difference through the generations.
So if I get some 20 more gold, I'm retired,
so I can't do the 1031 exchange because I can't put it to an IRA or any kind of retirement.
1031 exchange. Yeah, you know, and the 1031, if you have $20 gold pieces, it doesn't matter. The retirement account doesn't matter.
I'm trying to establish if I would take that and maybe trade it into the French and whatever the European coin, where it doesn't seem to be quite as much in demand now. And then how would we, you know, basically, what do you see? Is that a good idea? I'm thinking like maybe so.
The IRS is very finicky about foreign versus domestic, and if you want to argue for a like kind exchange, I would try to keep everything same and just make it a qualitative difference. But respect that there's qualitative similarities, not just even gold to gold. I'd take it a step further, and if I was trading, you know, high grade $20 gold pieces, MS64s or 5s, trading those for circulated $20 gold pieces. You know, where the difference in premium is because you've got one that's in pristine condition and then one that's basically junk, but it's still gold and it's still a $20 gold pieces. All you've done is gone from 20s to 20s. You see, I want to stay on the good side of the IRS, and I want to give myself as much of an argument as possible for like being like. One more question? Yeah. The tax man is basically playing the same game as any insurance company. They have the benefit of inflation through time. If you have a $1 million life insurance policy that you signed up for in the 1970s, $1 million in the 1970s was real money. I'm here to tell you $1 million today is nothing compared to what it was in the 1970s. So for that insurance company, the benefit of inflation through time has taken that liability, which seems significant to you up front. You know, that's why you paid all that you have. That's why you paid the premiums that you have, because you wanted that coverage. But they know that it's a future liability, and inflation is their friend. They get your money in the here and now, and they get to spend it, grow it, invest it, and it's a future liability degraded by inflation. What you're saying is that when you own gold and have appreciation in it, there's something very unjust about paying taxes on it, which we do anyways, but still, I mean, I appreciate your feeling on it, because a lot of the reason why it's grown is because the value of the currency itself has been degraded. It's not like Apple computers buying it at 90 and selling it at 700 and having that be because of the growth in the company and because of, you know, the gold story really is a story of inflation, which means that the government gets to keep a good part of what is not really theirs. Is that, yeah, I mean, I understand your frustration. You get to take all the risk, and they get to take an outsized percentage of the reward. That's why if you can be as efficient as possible, again, with an IRA allocation, thinking about the like-for-like exchanges, the premium, those kinds of things are very value-added through time. So, listen, thank you all for coming tonight. What we as a family have sort of grown into over 41, almost 42 years, are long-standing relationships with clients and families. And what I would encourage you to do is include us in a broader conversation. What I mean by that is we've known our clients long enough now to have experienced some awkward things in terms of an intergenerational transfer, where a lot of times the children of our clients will call and say, you know, my dad passed away. What are these things worth? We're liquidating them. There's no appreciation for what you've tried to create. There's no appreciation for the role that physical assets play in a long-term portfolio. There's no appreciation for having legacy assets. It's just, you know, this kind of conversation. I understand there's a delicate balance between sharing too many details with your kids or grandkids and not, but take the opportunity, at least in theory, to talk to them about why you do what you do. You don't have to share the specifics, but give them some training, give them some perspective. When we look at the conservative movement today, the conservative movement has shrunk and largely died, in part because there wasn't enough dinner table conversations. There wasn't a full transference of the importance of the issues in play. And I think when you think of the decisions that you're making financially, you know, in one generation, you know, they say when you're doing foundation work and trust work, it's shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. And it's because, you know, the first generation that earns it passes it on to the second generation. They never heard enough from their parents what happened and why, how they got to it. And what the first generation really wanted for the second generation was something a little bit easier. And by the time you get to the third generation, there's no appreciation for what they have. They just know they've got more money than Midas, and guess what happens to it? Shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. Have the conversations. If it's ever helpful for us to be involved in the conversation, the idea of coaching, talking about, you know, permanent metals position, what that looks like, we'd be happy to. I mean, we like the enduring nature of what we've done. We're a second generation family business, and I look forward to the third and fourth. How we dovetail with who you are and what you're doing, and your particular needs, just maybe need some time to think about that. But do let us know.
Well, David, as we were saying, you know, the questions never disappoint and the answers were good. This is a really critical time to be asking questions because prices and markets and a lot of the things that we're seeing in the press don't really match reality.
If there's a question that didn't come up in this Q&A and you would like to ask it personally of someone in our office, feel free to call 800-525-9556 and pursue that dialogue, or send us an email and we'll respond as fast as we can. Again, that's 800-525-9556, and look forward to continuing this kind of interaction with you directly.
Thanks for listening.